Way down in Missouri, when I heard this lullaby, while the stars were blinking and the moon was shining high.
Welcome to Showing Missouri, the History of Missouri, one county at a time. This week, we're talking about the history of Missouri with one of the most successful governors, one of the most prestigious families in the state's history. We are here with Governor Matt Blunt. Governor Blunt, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
So what I'd like to do, I'd like to maybe break this up into two parts. I don't think you can cover your life up to now in one setting, or at least I'd probably get a little antsy and maybe not do it right. I'd like to talk about today about the time up until you put your hand on the Bible as governor, or maybe up until you walked off that stage.
Okay.
There's a folks that know this, that they know a lot of the story. I know a lot of folks that know a lot of parts of the story, but I was going to get it right from the horse's mouth, your life and how you became. I mean, when you look back, you got to be proud of the time. I mean, you look at the accomplishments, and there's a lot of moving parts at the right time, but I mean, the waters were troubled, and you were able to come in with the Republican majority and accomplish more that, I mean, I don't even think most governors, you had to be a little surprised how much you got done.
Well, I was obviously thrilled with what we were able to do. And I think it was a time where there were real challenges for the state.
Yeah.
For too long, we'd sort of applied Band-Aids to get through each budget year after year without really getting into the structural issues. And I think we were able to do that and do that successfully. It was challenging and certainly didn't make for the easiest 2005, my first year as governor, but it definitely, within a year, really put our state on a much more stable foundation. And because of the fact that I had the privilege to be the first Republican governor with the Republican House and Senate in more than 80 years, that allowed us to get lots of things done that, you know, fundamentally changed not just our budget, but the state's business climate and our approach to economic development. And I think really got us thinking more about the future, how we ensure that we're prioritizing education. You can either be an education state or a welfare state. You really can't quite be both. That doesn't mean you shouldn't try and help those that truly need assistance. And certainly we did that, and we do that today and continue to do that. But you can either just be trying to fix problems and reacting to problems, or you can make investments in the future. And I think when you're investing in infrastructure, when you're investing in education, you're investing in the state's future, and you make Missouri a better place to live, work, and raise a family.
And to me, there's breaks in the state's history. Governor Dunklin, the state took a different track. Obviously, the Civil War, Governor Jackson, the state took a different track. You look down through with Governor Francis, the state took a different track. You could point to different times. I'm not sure you can really point to a different time until Governor Hearns. State was different after Governor Hearns. State was different after Kit Bond.
Yeah, absolutely.
State was different after Matt Blunt. And I don't think you can, none of your predecessors, none of the serious ones, have really taken any of your reforms and your changes and went back on them. And I kind of wanted to find out, one day I'd like to sit down again and talk about what those were. But
sure.
Let's talk about how you got there. It's so funny. I hear people all the time say, well, Greene County, the Blunt family. And I'm like, well, not exactly. The Blunt family in public service goes back to Webster County, Niangua, right?
Niangua, exactly. And Webster County is where my family was, my roots. Both of my sides of my family are sort of surround Greene County. My father's family was primarily from Dallas in Webster County, and then my mother's family was primarily from Lawrence County. So that's sort of where my roots are, and I spent a lot of time in both of those counties growing up with extended family and others. But I was born in Stratford, Missouri, right in the northeast part of Greene County.
Well, the folks in Webster County claim your dad, and if somebody tries to tell them otherwise, they don't have it. They don't
exactly.
Hear it.
Well, when I was born, he was a teacher at the Marshfield High School, so that's definitely was already employed in Webster County when I was first came into the world.
I always tell folks, if they'll go look at the pictures carefully enough in the legislature, they can find your grandfather. Tell folks about your grandfather.
My grandfather's a great guy. I got to spend a lot of time with all of my grandparents. Actually, I was fortunate. I had four great-grandparents when I was born, and I really knew three of them quite well. So I was really fortunate in that, and I think that was one of the great things about my childhood, having connectivity to people that had been born in the 1899 and could remember things about the first World War and tell stories about Missouri's past. But my grandfather was a great guy. When I was, most of the time I was little, He was a dairy farmer. And that's what he did up until he went to the Missouri House of Representatives in 1978. But he always continued to farm, and I spent a lot of time on that farm. This is actually the farm I was born on, was his farm, and it was where I spent a lot of time when he was dairy farming, and then when he was in the legislature, I spent a lot of time there as well and would help him put up hay and do stuff on the farm. He had a well-stocked pond that we would fish in, and we actually used cane poles, not a rod and a reel, but like a cane pole. And there's something to be said for the ease of a cane pole, particularly when you're a little kid. And it was a lot of fun. And he was a good man. I never heard my grandfather swear, ever. Which wow. is, if you've worked around a farm and farm equipment, that's not an easy thing to accomplish.
Well, my son can't say that. Maybe my grandson can say that one day. Maybe a little better yeah. about holding my tongue.
But he was definitely a great example. And his wife, my grandmother, was as well. Just a really strong strong woman. She was a little person, but had a lot of character and was a lot of fun. And I was really fortunate to spend as much time with him as I did.
So your dad was a teacher in Marshfield. Mm-hmm. Then he got into running for. Do you remember when he first started?
Well,
running for
I him? Don't because it would have been. I have memories of that house in Stratford that I was born in, and I can remember waking up on the steps, for example. For some reason, I thought it was smart to go sleep on the steps when I was 2 years old. Not outside, but inside, I'd sleep on the stairway. So I can remember some things about that house, but I don't really remember when he went to the courthouse. Now, he was appointed, because there was a vacancy, in the position of Greene County Clerk, and he was appointed by a Senator Bond. A Senator, my dad used to say he didn't know why Kip Bond had appointed him, and he was afraid to ask because he was afraid Kip wouldn't know why either. But there actually was a little more to it. I think Senator Bond, Governor Bond at the time, and this is something I've done in the past when I was governor too, said, let's let the local folks help make this decision. And the governor was going to appoint whoever the Greene County Central Committee recommended. And what my dad did as a, I guess, 23-year-old high school teacher in Webster County, though he was living in Greene County, was went to the committee members and in most cases just asked them if he could be their second choice. And went to all of them, and I think all of them had said, yeah, sure, you can be my second choice. And of course, there was a second ballot, so he was the person that the committee nominated to Governor Bond.
Well, that sounds like kind of pragmatic thing your dad would do, right?
Exactly.
Even at 23.
So he's appointed county clerk. And I do remember him being the Greene County clerk well. And I would go.
What's that like being in a political family? I mean, you got a grandfather in the legislature. Your father's in local office. I mean, that is there's a kinship I've seen amongst folks that grew up with a parent in public life. What kind of impression does that leave you with?
Well, I think it definitely just heightens your interest in the political process. And I'm sure I was much more interested than the average, probably the average adult, certainly the average child. And I think I'm sure that's true to some extent for all kids that are growing up with folks in office. My dad was really the first elected official, because my grandfather was elected actually after he had begun his service as Greene County clerk. Though he'd always been interested in politics, and I think my grandmother had been on the Central Committee and that sort of thing. My grandfather, I think, been on the school board in Stratford. I mean, you gotta, so he'd always been involved in the community.
It's a really unique experience for the Republican Party in the state, in maybe even a little bit, at least some. And parts of St. Louis used to be Republican back in the day have changed. Really, Cape Girardeau, the town of Cape Girardeau, maybe a little bit Jackson, then Southwest Missouri, those are the only places that were Republican after World War II, right? I mean, they stayed Republican. That's a rarity, though. That's kind of an interesting part of the state. The rest of the state, like the Boot Hill, North, they flipped.
Yeah, absolutely. It was clearly, it was definitely a Republican stronghold, and I think that goes back to the mid to late 19th century, and it's remained Republican ever since.
I always heard the Bushwhackers had a little bit to do with that. The Bushwhackers were so intense out there that it turned folks more Republican than they might have been otherwise.
Yeah, I think the simplistic telling has always been that it was a strong union area, and then that just translated into being Republican. I think there's some truth in that, though. I think if you were to look back at sort of 1850s and 1860s election results, there was more divided opinion as Missouri entered the Civil War. Clearly, the most challenging part of Missouri's history, actually. I don't think people realize just how dramatic the impact of the Missouri Civil
War. Well, it's complicated too, right?
It's so complicated and not really, you know, it's not easily, you can't just say, well, the southern half of the state was southern and the northern half. I mean, it was just, it was all over. And
it changed throughout the war.
And changed throughout the war, and people's feelings changed throughout the war. It was a real challenge for the state. I think I've read that there were about 1.5 million Missourians when the Civil War started. At the end of the Civil War, there were about 1 million people still living in the state.
I chuckled. I heard someone talk about how Vladimir Putin had taken to an area of the Donbass that was pro-Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And what he had done was damn near the same thing as General Order 11.
Made very little evacuate difference. Everybody.
Killed them, ran them out. Basically, he vacated this part of the Donbass of any people and any, well, that's a terrible thing. It's a terroristic thing. Read General Order 11 and tell me how it's different. Mm-hmm. Really no different. I mean, in Missouri, it's very complex. I don't think General Price went to that meeting with General, or Governor Price went to the meeting with General Lyon thinking they were going to succeed. I think they kind of, Lyon was such a jerk, they drove him out.
Mm-hmm.
I remember in Springfield, the Union forces wouldn't come collect Lyon's body. Then they wouldn't send a train for him. The Southern folks had to drive him to Rolla to turn him over. I mean, it's so many interesting things. It wasn't a slavery. I mean, there was partial parts of that, but Missouri was probably the most complicated state. And nowhere was it more involved than the Springfield area.
Right. I think President Lincoln even said that the Missouri problems were some of his biggest challenges during the Civil War, just trying to sort everything out and make the right decisions.
I said he wanted to be left alone. Isn't that a core Missouri thing? Just leave me alone, and we'll get along. So then your dad decides he's gonna, and this is, you know, there's a trajectory now that we think of in politics that you went down. You run for the legislature, maybe you run for Senate, or you run for statewide office after the legislature, and then you run for governor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, your dad went from local office to statewide office.
Yep.
That's an amazing thing. I mean, so you've actually been about 12, 13 when that campaign started?
Yeah, so actually though, the first big statewide campaign I remember, of course, was 1980, where he was a candidate for lieutenant governor. And, you know, Missouri used to be so challenging for Republicans that for a while, there was almost a pattern that Republicans sort of had to run once and lose just to kind of get their name out there and give people a chance to
see. Your predecessor went down that road, too. Bob Holden did the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
He ran statewide and lost, and then he
came back. Exactly. So my dad ran for lieutenant governor in 1980. Wasn't successful, but I think impressed a lot of people. And then in 1984, when Jim Kirkpatrick decided not to run again after his long and colorful tenure as Secretary of State.
What a legend to replace.
Yeah.
I mean, we tape our show sometimes at University of Central Missouri, and they have this big library, the Kirkpatrick Building. Uh-huh. I mean, what
they have a replica of his office, actually.
It's gorgeous. Uh-huh. I mean, it is amazing. And, I mean, you're replacing a Missouri institution at the time.
Sure. And my dad's got a lot of skill with that, and I just remember, and I think it was genuine. He had a genuine admiration and a fondness for Secretary Kirkpatrick, but I think he even took him, for example, to the first NAS meeting, National Association of Secretaries of State, with him just to spend time with him and have a smooth transition. And I think he did not hesitate to call him and ask him for advice and get his opinion on things. So definitely, but at the same time, my dad was a modernizing influence on the on the office. The state archives had probably been in neglect when he was secretary in the past, and they built a new, more modern facility to really safeguard and actually protect the state archives that we had. So made a lot of changes and improvements, but did so, I think, in a way that was respectful of his predecessor and his service to Missouri.
So you, when we go Secretary of State, you move. You come
to Jefferson. We did. Stratford's definitely been my Missouri home, but I moved to Jefferson City.
Well, that'll be at the start of high school, right?
Right at the start of high school, and that was a great experience. Yeah. Jefferson City was sort of an all-American town, and I had a great experience at the Jefferson City High School.
You know, I've seen, your brother. I've seen Jay Ashcroft, who moved here because of their father's having a very high-profile job. Both of them speak of it in the highest terms. Speak of getting to the time they got to live here was not a, oh, my God, I have to move for high school. I mean, maybe that was how it started, but they became people that really are promoters of it and really like Jeff City.
I think Jefferson City is a great, great community. I love my time in high school. It was a big high school at the time.
Yeah.
It was before they split the high school. But
I always heard Pete Atkins, the football coach, said you can't split it up because I need all the players, right?
And they didn't while he was around. Like,
and that's what they actually said. It wasn't like, oh, that's really, we're going to come up with some excuses. They're like, no, it's football. We can't do that.
Right. But it was a great experience. I think it prepared me well for what I did after high school.
Because you do, if you're here, you do get to meet people from all over the state.
Sure.
Sometimes all over the country, but certainly people from all over the state come here to serve, and not even just in the legislature, but in capacities with state government
And
things, and you really do get a feel for the state that you don't really get anywhere else but right here.
Yeah, well, Missouri's such a unique place. I think the only way you really can really experience Missouri is, because it's so diverse, and you know this because you travel around, and I'm listening to a lot of your county episodes, and they're a lot of fun, but you know, it's not natural to have, for example, somebody's sales territory be Missouri, because they'll divide it into the St. Louis side, mm-hmm. and the Kansas City side. Those are very different cities. But when you have the opportunity to travel the state, maybe as a child of a political candidate, but as a candidate, you just see how diverse our state is, and how remarkable it is, and how rich the history and culture of Missouri are. So I definitely got to experience that to an extent growing up, and then even more as an adult.
So you would have been then in high school, mm-hmm. when it was time for your dad to start putting together. Oh, yes, you'd have been, when you go to high school, then you go to the Naval Academy.
I went to the Naval Academy.
What's that decision like? I mean, I guess you had experienced a lot and seen a lot, but how does a person make that decision or find an interest in that from your background?
Sure. So I had always been interested in history, and I was always interested in military history, and I knew at a young age that I wanted to be involved in military service.
But I mean, that's not just something you walk in and say, I want to do this. I mean, there's a process.
Yeah, I definitely thought, I mean, I was from eighth grade on, I wanted to go to one of the service academies, and actually was more interested in West Point at first. I then visited, I think my junior year, I visited West Point and Annapolis, and then changed my mind, decided that Annapolis was a better fit for me, and but I was definitely very focused on it. Well, I don't know if it was the best. I think if you've been to Highland Falls, New York, and you've been to Annapolis, Maryland, seems like a bit more fun. Now, it doesn't really matter, because when you're a plebe, for example, it's not like you're spending a lot of time in the Annapolis community anyway. But definitely was a good fit for me academically, and then the Naval service is something I was really enjoyed and was proud of.
So you talk about service in there, history. I guess, is that what your dad taught?
He did teach history when he's not a high school teacher. Yep, he taught history.
And when you get a history degree, what do you plan to do with it?
Well, I think there's a lot of things you can do with it. I actually was a history major at the Naval Academy. Yeah. You take enough engineering, you sort of have an engineering minor, because it's actually a Bachelor of Science in history. But
what an interesting two things to have, right? I mean, most people wouldn't have an arts in history and then a science in engineering. That's an interesting combination.
It is an interesting combination. But I think there's lots of things you do with a history degree, and obviously folks, if they can teach,
could pursue
but
it, yeah.
There's lots of public history avocations and careers, and then of course people in history majors tend to have the sort of good writing skills and things that employers are hungry for, so I'd definitely be a booster of the history degree.
Now, when you're making that decision and you're at Annapolis, are you thinking, okay, I'm going to make public service part of what I'm going to do?
You know, I really never thought about elected service until maybe towards the end of my time at Annapolis or while I was in the Navy. When I went to the Naval Academy, I would not have thought I would someday be a candidate for public office.
So you're in a very challenging place. You don't graduate Annapolis without a lot of work.
It was a lot of work. It was a lot challenging for me in a lot of ways, but that was good for me.
And your dad runs for governor.
He ran for governor while I was at the Naval Academy.
And you always, I guess you assume that, okay, you win this office, you're going to serve in it while the current governor's there, then you're going to at least take a look at it and probably run for governor when it's open, right?
Mm-hmm.
What a campaign that, I mean, there's not a Republican, it's less now after 16 and the success. It was less after you won. But, I mean, the Republican Party in the state spent probably 15 years or better
getting over the
thinking, if your dad had won, what happens here?
Sure.
That had to be, you're in college. Could you come back and help much? What was the...
You know, I did come back for a month, because you only have, in the Naval Academy, you spend 2 months doing training with the fleet. Mm-hmm. But I came back for a month in 1992 and was able to work on and help in the campaign. And I was actually here it happened by chance that my time coincided with the actual election. So I was actually here for Election Day in August of 1992.
So got to be a little agonizing, right? See your dad in a
sure.
tough campaign.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
See, I mean, it's... and I was at junior high myself, so I don't know. But I've heard these stories that people knew that Webster had some issues, that whatever befall him, I think he got in trouble for using a copier, but there was a lot of second injury fund,
sure.
lots of smoke, right? And, you know, you do what I do long enough, you could get better at sifting through, okay, what's...
Right.
And especially when someone's in a very tough race, you'd have Democrats, you'd have other Republicans, but a lot of folks said in their gut they knew the FBI is secretive, but they knew something was up.
Mm-hmm.
But as I've heard from many, many people, he denied it to the end of that primary and even into the general, that there's nothing coming, there's nothing happening. It feels like a lot, maybe it's hindsight, but it feels like a lot of people thought in hindsight he did know or at least knew something was up, and some people around him. Mm-hmm. And if he would have bowed out, your father wins and probably wins the governor's mansion.
Well, I would think, I mean, I think, you know, Governor Carnahan's campaign was basically, my opponent's got a lot of legal problems and I want to raise your taxes by hundreds of millions of dollars. So I think my dad would have won if he'd been the general election nominee.
There's one thing about you and your father, there is no scandal about his public service ever.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
He was able to serve a very long time without anyone ever alleging any improprieties.
Sure.
And I would say his sheet would have been extremely white
sure.
then.
Right. But I imagine we've spent more time thinking about 1992 and what might have been than my dad has. He
really?
He picks up and moves on.
How's that
pretty
for you,
quickly.
Though? For you, that's got to be tough.
Well, I think for you, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure my dad would have been a great governor for the state. And
well, you love your father. You don't want to see him.
In the 90s were a time where you had a lot of states were doing some very innovative things. Welfare reform was occurring in a lot of states. So there would have been a lot of opportunities. There's a lot of things to think about what might have been. But I don't think my dad spent a lot of time dwelling on it. I think he was proud of the race he ran, and he came up short but moved on and obviously had a career that he wouldn't have imagined in the Congress and Senate.
I guess the question I'd ask is, do you think you probably could experience it somewhat when you're in college and know what's happening, but do you think Webster knew or not?
Well, I wouldn't want to say. I mean, I think
that's an unfair question, and I'll admit
he's
it.
Been through enough without me piling on.
Sure.
And I'm sure he, like all of us, has some things he regrets and decisions he made.
When you look back and see what your dad was able to do for the state of Missouri and the United States Senate,
mm-hmm.
I've had a chance to meet about a dozen senators that weren't from Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I tell them where I'm from, they bring up your dad, no matter who was the other senator. Hmm.
Interesting.
I've always felt like you couldn't get in this truck from anywhere in this state and drive more than a half hour and not find a water pipe, a road, an electric line, now broadband that either Kit Bond or your dad didn't bring to this state. You know, the way things work out sometimes is a crooked road. But boy, I tell you, I don't know that the average old boy who in West Plains today is swinging a hammer, who doesn't know, never will hear this, I don't know his life wasn't better the path your dad went down and allowed him to go to the United States Senate.
Yeah, I'm sure. There was no question. My dad has the skill set to be an effective United States senator and an effective member of Congress. He proved it. I think he understands you can either be a conservative that talks about getting things done, or you can be a conservative that gets things done.
Yeah.
And I think he decided to be a conservative that gets things done and recognizes he represented a diverse state with diverse interests and wanted to serve the folks of all across Missouri. And I think he did that effectively on so many different levels.
So you graduate Naval Academy and you stay in and serve as an officer, right?
Yeah, sure. I went, after I graduated from Naval Academy, I went to Surface Warfare Officer School. And then I went to a frigate out of Pascagoula, Mississippi called USS Jack Williams. And I was an officer in the engineering department on that ship.
Who's Jack Williams?
Jack Williams was a pharmacist mate from Arkansas who won the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I knew a history major would know the history of the ship.
He might have snubbed some people, but not me on that one. But it was a great experience. It was a small ship, but that's the type of ship that gives a junior officer a lot of opportunities. So, I got to serve in... Sort of on a ship, there's sort of three things you do when you're underway: engineering, Combat, which is the Combat Information Center, or serve on the bridge. And I got to do, got qualified in all three of those areas. So it was a good experience. That ship was underway a lot. There were times we'd be, I think there was, you know, maybe nine to 10 months of the year we'd be somewhere other than our home port. So it was pretty pretty rigorous.
Ain't really no grass ever grown under your feet about things, has there? I mean, you move quick.
I try to. Try to keep moving.
Tell, I want to step back a second. Tell us, a young person who's thinking about this, or maybe a dad listening to this, why they should pursue one of the service academies.
Well, I think that's actually a mixed question. I'm glad I went to the Naval Academy, mm-hmm. and I don't. There's, I think a lot of my life would be different if I hadn't. But it's, you know, it is a little. It's not a normal college experience, so I think there are pros and cons. What I would say with no reservation is I think being serving in the military is one of the best things a young person can do. Mm-hmm. And anybody that's thinking about, you know, trying to pursue the opportunity to be commissioned as an officer in the armed forces definitely would encourage that. And there's lots of different commissioning routes, whether it's service academies or OCS or ROTC. But that's, in a lot of ways, really shaped who I am. And definitely, you know, experiences were challenging, and there's probably easier things to do in life when you're in your 20s. Sure. But I'm not sure that for me there would have been anything better to do when I was a young man than to be an officer in the Navy.
Always thought of you as a disciplined person, disciplined politician, disciplined leader. Did you, were you born that way?
A little bit, but I'm sure it was enhanced, definitely enhanced by my my service as a naval officer.
So tell me about a lady you met named Melanie.
Sure. So Melanie, I met Melanie, my first ship, that Jack Williams. We were coming back from actually the Eastern Pacific, went through the Panama Canal, and we're pulling into a port. And this doesn't happen a lot, but that ship ran aground. Now, I need to be clear, I was the navigator of my second ship, not the Jack Williams, mm-hmm. not the ship that ran aground. But it happened, and we did quite a bit of damage, actually. And we got towed to Norfolk, and some friends and I, we were, you know, just started to get these repairs done. It was going to take a few months because it was significant damage to the screw of the ship. Went to Richmond, Virginia, and I met Melanie Blunt and Melanie Anderson at the time in Richmond, Virginia. And you want to say you met like in a, you know, Salvation Army volunteering or something, but we met at a local establishment in that town and started to date, and we were engaged within 3 months and married within a year.
Folks that travel out there for work, where was the establishment? What part of town?
It was called Cobblestone Brewery, which would be, I guess, in what's called the Shaco Bottom of Richmond. But I'm not sure that the Cobblestone Brewery is still in business. But we are. We're still happily married after a quarter of a century.
So if Samuel Clemens hadn't wrecked a riverboat and the Navy hadn't ground a ship, he wouldn't be a famous author, and you might not be married to her.
That's very true. It'd be hard to imagine we would have I would have had any reason to be in Richmond and meet her.
So how does Matt Blunt ask her out?
What's that?
How does Matt Blunt ask her out?
Okay, well, actually, I was there with three other friends from the ship, and
are you in your white?
No, we're just in civilian clothes, trying to relax, and we kind of did some sightseeing, and we're out for the evening. And actually, there was a coaster on the bar, and I picked it up, and I said, I can meet somebody in this bar with this coaster. And I went up to Melanie and her friend. They were actually eating dinner. They weren't just hanging out.
Well, that makes it even tougher.
So they were having some sort of soup and salad, I think, at this table. And I just went over and I introduced myself. And I said I was thinking about starting a brewery, and I was going to name it after myself. And then I showed them this coaster, and it said Studley Ale. And it had this sort of Minuteman-looking guy on it.
And that worked?
That worked.
I gotta write that down. It's not bad.
So again, we met and established connections and dated while I was getting the ship fixed, and continued to date after my ship had returned to Pascagoula, Mississippi. I would drive up.
That took a little work, right?
That's a lot of work, lot of driving.
Richmond to Pascagoula, if my geography's right, it's a handful hour drive, right?
It's probably about four, I think it was about four, maybe 10 to four, 10, I'm trying to remember. It was at least 10 hours.
So how long do you two date before you think, well, maybe?
Well, we were engaged in 3 months.
You don't let grass grow under you,
no.
Do you?
And then married within a year.
Well, so you get out of the Naval Academy, right?
Uh-huh.
Out of the Navy, I'm sorry.
Yep.
And you're still in the reserves, I guess?
But well, I was. Married? Now, see, so we got married, and I went to my second ship.
Now, how do you ask her to marry you after 3 months? Because, I mean, that's making time.
It's definitely making time. But she didn't. She may have had second thoughts later, but she didn't hesitate at the time, and we got married.
Well, tell folks how you popped the question. I mean, that's something you put a little time into thinking about, right?
Well, you know, I didn't put a lot of thought into that one. I probably should have, but I just sort of showed up at her front door
in 90 days, closed the deal.
And yep,
nice. That's impressive, I have to say. Mm-hmm. So tell folks about her.
Well, she's a. She's a remarkable person, and at the time she was running a store. She'd gone to college in Virginia and was running a store and hard worker. You know, she is definitely somebody that early in life was, you know, very determined to succeed. She went to college, probably the first person in her family to graduate with a 4-year degree in college, and waitress, for example, at the she actually was in it's a rural county, Fluvanna County, Virginia, which at the time didn't have a single stoplight, and she was a waitress at the Fork Union Motor Lodge, and did that every summer. And I think when she was home from breaks from school, and she still has, I think, a lot of sympathy for folks that are. Waiting tables in a restaurant, and she knows how hard that job can be.
You sometimes see that bill and think, well, there's no way lunch costs that.
Right.
You know, that was a good tip, right?
Right, exactly. But a hard worker and, you know, just a really remarkable person. And I think she was thrown, she did not come from a political family, so definitely thrown into politics at a young age. I think she knew when we met that I was interested in politics and government, but I think she thought that's something we'd do much later in life, mm-hmm. not when I was in my...
I mean, she had to know the guy that proposed to her in 90 days didn't mess around, right?
Right, but she would have been, I was 33, she was 31 when she was the first lady. She was by far the youngest first lady in the country at the time. So I was really thrown into it, but I think thrived and certainly grew in that role, and now continues to be very involved in the local community that we live in.
So you get married, mm-hmm. you come in 97, you come back and you're running for state rep.
I came back in 1998, actually. I got out of the Navy in May.
Pre-term limits.
So limits.
They were about to kick in, but hadn't kicked in.
Yep.
How'd the seat come open?
A guy named Phil Wanamaker decided not to seek re-election. And I think he was actively looking for folks that could be candidates. Mm-hmm. And I talked to him at some point in either 1997 or 1998 and told him I was interested. And that district was the 139th district, was sort of northern Greene County, north Springfield, a little bit of western Springfield.
And by now your father's a congressman?
He is a congressman.
Yep.
His first term in the Congress.
So not exactly the same set of issues that Lincoln Huff had when he ran. I mean, you had a probably thought when you decided to run, you had a high percentage of winning this, right?
I did. You know, that's a race where, in some ways, of all the races I had, that's one I maybe worried about the most, because it wasn't as... It was a little more competitive district than you think. The other thing is, when you're running for state rep, I mean, people, you know, you're really
wanting
every day.
Know, yeah.
I knocked on every door in the district at least twice. So
you did personally.
Personally. So, you know, even if you're going to do really well, 2 out of 5 doors you knock on, they're not for you.
Yeah.
And that's a 60. If you went for 60% of the vote, you're constantly interacting with folks that, for one reason or another, are not. For you, many of them are polite and don't tell you that, but some of them do.
Yeah.
So you know, it's.
Well, were you worried a little about? Okay, I have not lived here for a while.
For a while,
I moved away with my father, Jeff City. I've been in the Naval Academy. I'm coming back.
Right.
Lots of roots, but it is a very well known name, and maybe folks will turn that on you. And that's whenever that doesn't work, it's usually something like that, right?
Right, yeah. And the gentleman I ran against, a guy named Al Erb, had been a superintendent of schools in Fairgrove.
Really?
So he was a nice gentleman.
This is a real race then.
Yeah, it was. But I mean, it turned out to, you know, we did win by a substantial margin. But, you know, it was a great experience. You learn a lot about how people live when you knock on.
As you go to their house, yeah.
You go to their house and catch them, you know, spur of the moment and see what's going on.
I think people that have ran for office and had to knock on the door, you never walk up to a house anymore without looking at the bumper sticker, looking at how they have their shrubs done, looking at something to compliment. I think if you've knocked on them doors, it's just in your mind somewhere, you just walk up. When I ran for mayor, I did the same thing. Every house twice, didn't matter if you registered or not. And to this day, if I walk up to a new house, I start just instinctively looking at, well, I might talk about that Knights of Columbus sticker or whatever it is. You know, just you can't help it.
It's a great experience. I definitely learned. I learned a lot in that race. And again, it was an area of pretty divergent socioeconomic situation. So, you know, there's some families that really were challenged just to get by. Others maybe a little more affluent, but certainly not a wealthy district by any means. And definitely learned a lot in that experience, and again, just came to really appreciate people. I mean, there's a lot of good, God-fearing people in our state, and certainly I knocked on a lot of their doors in that race.
So you come serve in the State House, and I always heard this story. You had the smallest office in the entire Capitol, right?
That's very possible. It was small.
It was smaller than the studio. I mean, it was
definitely smaller.
Rod Jetton's first office was known, by then you were Secretary of State, he was known as your office, and it was the smallest thing.
It might have been smaller than this stage.
Yeah.
It was a small, office.
You had to move the chair in for somebody's set, or you couldn't shut the door without moving the chair.
Yeah,
that's how small the office was.
It was a small office, absolutely. So I came to the legislature. You know, we were in the minority party then.
Democrats complained today about how they're treated. They have no idea. The margins were tight at the time. They had to run that thing really tightly and treat you guys terribly.
Well, I wouldn't want to say that. I mean, we were...
Comparatively to how the Democrats are treated today, the Republicans were treated much more disrespectfully. But now the margins are enormous. Back then, well, you guys were working with an 8-10 seat margin?
It was at least 10, maybe 12.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, it was a...
But you had pro-life Democrats that would throw down. You had... It was a very... that you had Danny Staples and Lacey Clay in the same party at one time.
Absolutely.
I mean, they agree on what, like labor and trial attorneys, and that might be it. Yeah,
right,
I mean,
right.
It was a very tough caucus to run, and so the rules they had made sense if you think about how they had to actually get the gears to run. That's part one of our discussion with the 54th governor of the great state of Missouri, Matt Blount, about his career leading up to his inauguration. Hope you'll join us next week for part two here on Show Me Missouri. Thrifty Missouri, one county, and this time, one statesman at a time.
We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance, and we're for the Missouri way of life. We're for worrying less about the what-ifs and more about the why-nots. We're for checking off your bucket list and then making a new one. For starting a family, a business, a tradition. And if you find yourself starting over, we're here for that too. We're for building a life in Missouri and then going out and living it. And when it comes to making sure everything you've built is protected, we're for you. We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance.
The Show Me Missouri podcast is brought to you by our friends at HALO, Heartland Area Landowners. HALO is a membership-based organization for folks interested in farming the sun and the wind. HALO members are passionate about their land, our world, and stewarding the resources that feed America, power, and its economy. Farming the sun and wind has incredible benefits for farmers, landowners, and all Missouri communities, all while helping secure America's energy independence. To learn more about HALO and how you can get involved, visit heartland.owners.farm. That's heartlandowners.farm.